Merchant Lift Chips.
Thank you for the introduction. So it's my very first time to come to the Perimeter Institute, and so far everything looks very, very nice. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to present some of my recent work. Do I get a pointer?
Just click onto your pocket.
Oh, okay.
That's the traditional PI pointer.
Okay, it's a little bit brutal, but yeah, okay. So I will talk about the algebraic Bose liquid phase and emerging the Lipschitz gravity theory. And so this is the outline of my talk. And in the introduction, I will first define some concepts because I believe not everyone is familiar with those concepts. I will define what the emergent physics and emerging excitation means, and I will also define algebraic Bose liquid phase. And then I'm going to talk about some well-known example of the algebraic Bose liquid phase, which is the Bose model with the photon excitation at very low energy. And I'm going to show you the importance of the self-duality in the argument of the stability of the algebraic Bose liquid phase. And then I'm going to move on to a new example of the algebraic Bose liquid phase, which has the Z equals 2 or Z equals 3 Lipschitz gravity theory as the low and defective field theory. But of course, I have to talk about the linearized Lipschitz gravity theory in my talk. And I'm also going to show that both theories are self-dual. And if there is extra time after this main part of my talk, I'm going to tell you something else, some other kind of the emergent physics, some other kind of a liquid state we actually observe, and we can engineer very naturally in condensed matter system. For instance, some strongly coupled liquid state in a coupled ET, spin liquid state, and also some emergent QCD and emergent very large global flavor symmetry, SUN flavor symmetry with n as large as 10 can emerge in cold atom system. Okay, if there's a time, I will tell you about that. Okay, let me start with the introduction. Okay, let me start with a very, very general question. So suppose I define a quantum many-body system on lattice. Suppose I define a quantum local many-body system on lattice. Then how do I guarantee there is a gapless or massless spectrum? So this question is non-trivial in the following sense. Since we started with a system on the lattice, which means that the input energy scale of the system is very high. It's the ultraviolet card of the system. So we input a very high energy, but somehow many, many systems can still maintain a gapless spectrum. Okay. The simplest example is the interacting fermion system. So we know that for non-interacting fermions, we will form a Fermi surface. This is from our quantum mechanics book in undergraduate classes. The fermions will like to form a Fermi surface. It turns out that for interacting fermion, as long as the interaction is not strong enough, it's not extremely strong, the fermions will always try to form a Fermi liquid. We always try to form a Fermi surface. For instance, this example of the Fermi surface in a solid, in a crystal. Okay. So around the Fermi surface, there will be tons of gap excitation. So somehow the fermion system will always try to maintain a gap spectrum, even though we input a very large kinetic energy length scale or interaction energy scale to the system. However, the situation for boson is very different. For boson system, somehow we will have to fine-tune some parameter to get a critical point, to get a gapless point. For instance, this is the Lagrangian for ordinary boson, for one component scalar boson. And in order to get a gapless spectrum or massless spectrum, we will have to fine-tune the R to zero. Okay, this is what we have to do to get a critical point. And this is a quantum critical point phase diagram. So by tuning the control parameter R, we can drive an ordered phase to a distorted phase transition. And the quantum critical point here will be gapless. And sometimes, in the ordered phase, we'll always be gapless, and we'll also be gapless. But the gapless stations are called the Goldstone modes. Because sometimes the ordered phase will break some continuous symmetry spontaneously. For instance, let me consider a simplest spin model on the lattice. So this is a spin vector, and it's the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model for on the lattice. And now let's imagine we are at the zero temperature. Then, of course, at zero temperature, those spins will try to order. For instance, let's imagine a spin will order along this direction. Okay? And now suppose I create a very long wavelength modulation of the spin of the order parameter direction create a very long wavelength modulation, then we can see that the kind of energy difference between the excited state and the ground state is very, very small. It's actually gapless if you make the wavelength long enough. Okay. So this actually the Goldstone theory actually tells us once in the system we spontaneously break a continuous symmetry, we're always going to get the gapless station, which are called the Goldstone mode. Okay. So now we have these kind of examples. So let me refine my question a little bit more to make it more non-trivial. Okay. Let me refine my question this way. So can we guarantee a gapless and a massless spectrum in an unfine-tuned interacting simple boson system on the lattice, but we don't want to have the symmetry breaking? Okay. How do we do that? So without using the Goldstone theorem, how do I guarantee the spectrum is gapless or massless? Okay. This is a little bit more non-trivial question. So suppose we can find these kind of systems. Okay, suppose we can find these kind of systems, then these kind of gapless stations are called emergent gapless stations because they are not guaranteed by Goldstone theorem. And the phase with these excitations are called algebraic boson liquid phase. Okay, this is a very simple definition of the algebraic boson liquid phase, but I will define a little bit more rigorously later. Okay. So now let me first explain a little bit more about the word emergence. So what does emergence mean? So emergence actually means that at high energy, I only have very, very simple symmetry. For instance, at a high energy, I only want my system to have the simplest symmetry, which is the U1 global symmetry of the boson, which is associated with the boson number conservation. Okay, this is the symmetry I'm going to assume. Okay. By assuming the kind of very simple symmetry on the lattice, actually sometimes we can see at low energy a lot of different kinds of symmetry can emerge. So this is what I meant by emergence. But actually different people may actually define emergent field in a different way. So, I mean, many other people may give you a more broader definition. They may actually call anything exotic happening on the lattice will mean emergent. But here I actually constrain my definition to be that on the lattice I only assume a very simple symmetry. Okay. Now let me explain the word liquid. Okay, what is liquid? So the Wikipedia gives us the definition for liquid, which is that in a liquid, the atoms do not form a crystalline pattern or any other long-range order, which means that the liquid is a state which does not break any symmetry. Okay, so then how about the liquid on lattice? So we know the lattice already breaks some symmetry, or it breaks the translation symmetry or the rotation symmetry over the space. So when I talk about the liquid on lattice, I mean a state which does not break any more symmetry than a symmetry that has already been broken by the lattice. For instance, the Fermi liquid is an example. Okay. Fermi liquid is an example because in the Fermi liquid in the solid, the crystal already break some symmetry of the space, but the Fermi liquid will still be, I mean, will not break any more symmetry than that. Okay. An algebraic boson liquid means that it does not break any U1 global symmetry that I assume on the lattice, and does not break any lattice symmetry. And also, it has the algebraic or power law density-density correlation between the boson density, and also has the gap excitations here. Okay. So do we have examples of the algebraic boson liquid or not? Turns out in one dimension, it's very easy to have this kind of example, because in 1+1 dimension, or 2 dimension, or 1+1 dimension, there is a Mermin-Wagner theorem, which says that any global continuous symmetry cannot be spontaneously broken in 1+1 dimension or 2 dimension. So it turns out that suppose we have an interacting boson system, more often than not, the bosons will try to form a state which does not break any symmetry. This kind of state called Latindre liquid state. And it can be described by the C equals N conformal field theory, and C is a central charge and N is the number of components of the bosons. Okay. So this example, the algebraic boson liquid phase. And suppose we are willing to enlarge the symmetry a little bit more, we can realize all kinds of conformal field theory in one dimension with just spin chain. For instance, what do we want to realize the SUN, the level K, with the Minow-Witten model, which is the conformal field theory, we can realize in a K orbital SUN spin chains. And if I have time, I will show you how do we generalize the SUN spin chain condensed matter system. Okay. Turns out that in 2 dimension or even higher dimension, if you assume the system has a 1-dimensional-like symmetry, okay, we can make the system behave like a 1-dimensional system. And this kind of a one-dimensional system, and sometimes we call it kind of situation, a dimensional reduction situation. However, this kind of system is not emergent physics I'm talking about, because we will have to assume some very large one-dimensional symmetry. For instance, in this kind of system, we will have to assume a boson is not conserved in the whole space, but also conserved along every one-dimensional line of the lattice. If we assume the boson number is conserved along every one-dimensional line of the lattice, actually we can make the system behave like a one-dimensional system. For instance, we can make a system not condensed, not break any global symmetry. However, this is not this is not in the same spirit of the emergent physics I just defined, because I will have to assume a very large symmetry on the lattice. And this kind of approach was started by many people, including myself. Okay, so in this talk, I'm going to focus on something more strict. Okay, I'm going to refine my question a little bit more, and this is the final version of the question I'm trying to address. So I will try to guarantee a gapless and massless spectrum in an unfine-tuned interacting simple boson system on 2D and 3D lattice with no symmetry breaking. Okay, this is the question I'm going to address in this talk. So here I have to make sure it's 2D and 3D, and also no symmetry breaking. Okay, so before I move to examples, let me review some philosophy difference between the high-energy physics and the condensed matter physics. In high-energy physics, we know there's a standard model, which is a low-energy theory of whatever theory, whatever ultimate theory it is. So at low energy, we know the particles are behavioral particles are described by a standard model, which is the SU3 cross SU2 left cross U1 gauge theory. So we know the low-energy theory, but if we want to know the high-energy theory, since we don't have the strong enough colliders, so we have to assume a lot of things. For instance, we have to assume the high-energy theory has a supersymmetry. It's a very large symmetry, and sometimes we also have to assume it has a very large gauge symmetry. For instance, SU5 grand unified theory has a very big gauge symmetry. Okay, so which means the high-energy theory has a lot more symmetry compared with the low-energy theory. And when we lower the energy scale, this symmetry will get spontaneously broken. Okay? It will break and break and break, and finally we end up with the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 the standard model. Okay? So this situation of high energy. But in condensed matter, the philosophy is completely opposite. In most cases, we know the high energy theory. Okay? In condensed matter, in most cases, we know the high energy theory, but we don't know the low energy theory. For instance, in the most mystery, high-temperature superconductor, we know precisely what the high-energy theory is. At least most people believe the high-energy theory is known, which is the Hubbard model. It's just a very simple Hubbard model with very simple SU2 spin symmetry and also the U1 symmetry associated with the particle number conservation. Okay, this is the only symmetry we have at the high-energy theory. But at low-energy theory, many, many things can happen. Like we have an antiferromagnet magnet here. We have a superconductor and a Fermi liquid and something called pseudo-gap and strained metal, which no one really knows what they are. But they are there. So which means that in condensed matter system, at least in those mystery condensed matter system, we know the high-energy theory, but we don't know the low-energy theory. And this is the spirit I'm going to take in my talk. So in high energy, I'm always going to assume a very simple symmetry. I'm always going to assume a U1 global symmetry associated with the particle number conservation. And in low energy, we can see a lot of different things can happen in our model. Okay. So now let me move on to the examples. I'm first going to tell you some well-known example of the algebraic boson liquid phase, which is the boson model with photons. Okay. So let me first start with a simple model, which is the Boser-Hubbard model on the square lattice or cubic lattice or any kind of lattice it is. So this kind of Boser-Hubbard model is the very standard model people use to describe a quantum interacting bosonic system. It has several very simple terms. For instance, this term is a nearest neighbor hopping term. It hops particles from one side to the nearest neighbor side. It just does this. And the U term is the on-site density repulsion term. It's going to give them an interaction energy between the particles on the same side. And the mu is the chemical potential, which will tune the average filling of the boson on every side. Okay. And the phase diagram of the Bose-Hubbard model can be very easily understood. For instance, when T is much larger than U, then this term will dominate the entire Hamiltonian. So the only thing we need to do is to minimize the kinetic energy. And the best way to minimize the kinetic energy is to form a superfluid phase, to form a phase coherence between boson on different sides. Okay, that's the best way to minimize the kinetic energy. And in the superfluid phase, of course, the U1 global symmetry is spontaneously broken, and we have a Goldstone mode. Okay. And suppose we make U much larger than T. Okay, we go to the opposite limit. We make U much larger than T, then it turns out that we are going to have a mod insulator phase. In this phase, it turns out that on every side, there is a fixed value of the boson filling. For instance, in this lobe, on every side, there is one particle precisely. And the particle number cannot fluctuate very strongly, cannot fluctuate. Okay. So in this phase, there's no symmetry breaking, and the spectrum is gapped. So in this kind of a very simple Bose-Hubbard model, we either have a phase with symmetry breaking and a gapped spectrum, or do we have a phase with no symmetry breaking and a gapped spectrum. So which means that the simplest quantum boson model, the Bose-Hubbard model on a square lattice, will not work. Okay. So our goal, question? Okay, so our goal is to try to get an algebraic boson liquid phase from a Bose-Hubbard type of model in two dimension or three dimension. Okay, this is the goal of my talk. Okay. So let me modify the Bose-Hubbard model a little bit on the square lattice. So now the Hamiltonian contains three terms, with the HU, HV, and HT. So HU term is, again, a very simple on-site repulsion between boson numbers. And now, actually, I want to define the bosons on the links of the lattice instead of on the side of the lattice. And now the bosons are all on the links of the lattice. And this term and the U term is just an on-site repulsion between boson numbers on the same link. And this term, again, is the nearest neighbor boson hopping. It's going to move a boson from this link, and to other links. It's a boson hopping. And the most important term is this term. It's a square of the sum of a boson around every site minus some average filling. Okay? The most important is this term. And the n bar can be anything. Can be anything. So,
what is mu?
Mu is the direction. It's either x or y. Okay. So this side is I. So ix means this link. Iy is this link. Yeah. Thank you for asking. I forgot to explain. Okay, this is mu means a link. Okay. So this term is very important. It just means that the sum of these links, boson number on this link, minus 4n bar squared. And let's take n bar equals 1/2. Okay, just like that, let's take n bar equals 1/2. So this means that suppose this term is the largest term of the system. Suppose we make this term the largest term of the system. Then this term will favor around every side, there are precisely two bosons. Right, this term will favor that. So there are a lot of configurations allowed with this kind of constraint. We can feel this, and we can move these two particles to these two particles, which are all going to be consistent with this constraint. Okay. So now suppose this term dominate everything else, then this term, the HV term, will divide the Hilbert space into a low-energy Hilbert space and a high-energy Hilbert space. And there's a constraint in the low-energy Hilbert space. Okay. And what is the simplest way to describe that constraint? The simplest way is to introduce another field on the link. And we call the field an electric field. It's defined on the link. And the electric field equals to the boson density minus n bar times eta. And eta is just some static sign distribution on the lattice. For instance, for all the red link, we give a plus sign. For the blue link, I give a minus sign. Okay, just some boson number times some sign. So after I do this, then the constraint on the low-energy Hilbert space can be rewritten in this very compact form. Okay. which are sum of the boson density minus 4 m bar, can be rewritten like this, which is the divergence of the electric field equals 0. And this is a Gauss law constraint. We can recognize the precise the Gauss law constraint. Okay. And now suppose I rewrite the boson annihilation operator B as exponential I theta. We can also do this because the theta is the phase angle of the complex boson creation operator B. And now again I introduce another field which I call a vector potential A equals to the theta times this sign. Equals to theta times this sign, then we can check A and E are a pair of canonical conjugate variables. We can check that. Okay, so which means that this kind of Gauss law constraint will induce a gauging variance, which is A can be added with A can add any gradient of our arbitrary function, and it's not going to change the low energy dynamics. Okay. So let me see. So now let me show you how this kind of gauging variance literally emerge. Okay, let me show you how it emerge at a low energy. Okay, so let me start with one plaquette, and I put two bosons on these two links, and let me move this boson around with the nearest neighbor hopping. Okay. Let me move the boson around with the nearest neighbor hopping. Then the first step, I move one particle from this link to this link. Okay, let me do this, and then by doing this, we can show that we will make two sides very unhappy because we have to violate the constraint on this side and also violate the constraint on this side. Okay, these two sides will not be happy. Then the only way to make them happy is to move this particle from this link to this link. Right. So to do this with a second order perturbation theory. So this is a second order effect which involves two steps of the nearest neighbor hopping. And this kind of effect is called a ring exchange. It's called the ring exchange, which can be described by this kind of term, okay? B1 dagger, B3 dagger, and then B2, B4, which means we always annihilate these two particles and create these two particles. Okay? This is the ring exchange term. And T, as I said, is a second order perturbation effect. So T will be T2 squared over V. And V is the very larger term I turned on, which imposed the constraint. So now suppose I rewrite this term in terms of the vector potential. Now the Hamiltonian takes exactly the same form of the compact QED. Okay? Because this term, after I introduce the vector potential, it becomes the cosine curl A. It's just the compact QED, E squared plus the cosine curl A. It's a compact QED.
Can you remind us
what
theta was?
Theta?
Yeah.
Oh, theta is just is this. The B equals to exponential. Okay. So now we already see how we got the gauging variance at low energy. We just do the perturbation theory, and we will see there's a gauging variance emerge within the low energy Hilbert space. Okay. And actually, this kind of gauging variance is emergent because at the high energy model, I only have the U1 global symmetry. But a low energy model, I turned out to have the gauging variance. Okay, so now the question is: does the gauging variance guarantee the spectrum is gapless or not? Because in the ordinary field theory book, we all learn that the gauging variance makes sure that the spectrum is gapless because the mass term will violate the gauging variance. But turns out that for this kind of a compact theory on the lattice, when the boson number and the electric field are discrete, this is not always the case, okay, because the topological excitation can easily gap out those photon excitations, can gap out the gap excitations. And to study this kind of compactness of the theory, the best way is to go to a dual theory. Okay, now let me introduce the dual formula in 2 plus 1 dimension. For instance, in a dual theory, I want to solve this constraint automatically. So this means that I have to define a dual field H, which is a scalar field on the plaquette center. I define H field on the plaquette center. And I will write down E equals to some gradient H cross the Z direction vector. And it means that this boson number here equals to this H minus this H. And the boson number here equals this H minus this H. Boson number here this H minus this H, and so on. So this means that after I define boson number this way, we add the boson number together, it will be 0. Right? So which means that after I define the boson number, so after I introduce the dual field H I automatically solve the gauge constraint. I automatically solve the constraint. So now we are dealing with an unconstrained Hilbert space instead of a constrained Hilbert space now. And also I can rewrite curl A as pi. And because E and A are a pair of conjugate variables, we can check that H and pi are also a pair of canonic conjugate variables. So now the kind of a compact QED Hamiltonian can be rewritten this way. In the cosine of pi plus gradient H squared. And this kind of duality simply is a lattice and a compact version of the ordinary gauge field and a superfluid duality, which is familiar to many people. Okay. So now the dual Lagrangian looks exactly like the superfluid Lagrangian. Okay. It looks like this. So by solving this Lagrangian, it's a Gaussian theory, so it's very trivial to solve it. By solving the Gaussian field theory, you can see that there is a gap recitation with a linear dispersion. This is what we can see by solving the spectrum. However, we missed one very important point, which is that H is essentially a discrete field. H can only take integer value. This is because the boson number is discrete. Boson number can only take integer value. So the electric field is a staggered sign times the boson number can also only take integer value. And so the H can also only take the integer value or half integer value, at least discrete values. Okay. So this implies that in the dual field theory, I'm allowed to turn on a term like this, which is a cosine 2 pi h. So cosine 2 pi h will fix h at some discrete minima. Okay, so I'm allowed to turn on the cosine 2 pi h term in the dual theory. Okay, so now let's see what kind of effect this term will do to the spectrum. Turns out that this term is a very, very relevant perturbation. What do we calculate correlation function between these two operators, between these two operators as a Gaussian field theory is going to have a very long-range correlation, which means that it's a very relevant perturbation. And when we have a very relevant perturbation like this in a Gaussian field theory, we know that it's going to gap out the spectrum automatically. Okay, a very, very tiny vertex operator like this, so we call it the vertex operator. So a very tiny vertex operator like this will gap out the spectrum automatically. Okay, so which means that in 2 plus 1 dimension, the boson model does not have a gapless excitation, even though it has a gating variance at a low energy.
What is alpha dependent?
Sorry?
What is alpha dependent?
Alpha depend on the T, V, U of the, of the original model, but this is not a very good way to calculate it. I mean, physically, alpha corresponds to the fugacity of the monopole in the space-time, but I'm not sure how to calculate very precisely, though.
But can I take both signs, plus and minus? Or?
Well, in most cases, it's plus sign. Most cases, plus sign. But at the alpha can have a staggered sign. Both have a staggered sign. Some side is a plus, some side is a minus. Then the cosine 2 pi h will not be the only term allowed. With the cosine 4 pi h, cosine 8 pi h will have a uniform sign. So those terms will give you a more important contribution to the cosine 2 pi h. But in the simplest case, the cosine 2 pi h will give you a uniform sign. So this is actually a most important term. Okay. So we already see that in 2 plus 1 dimension, the vertex operator is a very important contribution to the field theory, which will gap out the spectrum. Now how about 3 plus 1 dimension? Okay. In 3 plus 1 dimension, we basically do the duality in the same way. Okay.
We still solve the Gauss law constraint, but now we solve it by introducing a vector dual field H. Okay. We solve this, we have to introduce this guy. And then by doing this in the dual field theory, we'll look very much like the 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. Instead of a scalar H, we have a vector H. And still, we have to allow the vertex operator, because H is still essentially a discrete field. H essentially can only take discrete values. So we still allow the vector. So we still allow the vertex operator here.
What is cosine of a vector?
Sorry?
Oh,
just cosine hx plus cosine hy plus cosine h.
I guess the sum.
Yeah, the sum of. Sorry. That's a notation. That's a bad notation. Okay. So now we can see the Gaussian part of the theory has a gating variance, has a dual gating variance, but it's not there in the two dimensions. But in the 2 plus 1 dimension, the Gaussian part has a gating variance. So h can still, at any gradient of any arbitrary function, still going to be unchanged.
And this vertex operator here will violate the gating variance. Right? This vertex operator it's not consistent with this gating variance. So which means that suppose I start with a theory, and suppose we start with a phase described by this Gaussian field theory, and if I turn on a small vertex operator like this,
this term will be irrelevant because it breaks the gauging variance. If you calculate a correlation function between the two vertical operator like this, it's going to vanish at a long distance. So this means that at least for a small vertex operator, it's not going to gap out the spectrum. It's not going to do anything in Gaussian theory, right? As long as it's small. So this actually tells us that, so this vertex operator is only relevant when the dual gauging variance is spontaneously broken by condensing some topological defects.
Is all this only way down at low energy where the dispersion relation is linear?
Sorry?
Is all this good only at low energy where the dispersion relation
No, it's not. I mean, so actually, in the main part of the talk, will be quadratic and cubic dispersion, but still you can see the vertex operator gets suppressed this way. For the same reason, it will be suppressed. As long as the dual theory has a large enough gauging variance. And it doesn't really care whether the gauge field is quadratic, has a quadratic dispersion, or cubic dispersion, or linear dispersion. So the argument will always hold. So basically, this means that so this term can only be relevant when we spontaneously break the dual gauging variance by condensing the topological defect. As long as it's not condensed, then the gauging variance is still there. Then this term will be irrelevant. Okay. So which means that simple divide actually guarantees that there's a gap in space. There's a gap in space. And so just now I did a lot of things to prove the simple duality, but it turns out that the simple duality is something we learned from very basic EM class in undergrad. Okay. So just have a simple duality between the electric field and the magnetic field of the Maxwell equation. We know the Maxwell equation without a matter field looks like this. And we can and we are free to switch the E field and B field in the equation, and actually it looks the same. And the H field is the E squared plus the B squared, which we are free to exchange E and B. Okay. And in the gap space, the boson density-density correlation is algebraic, because we can calculate the boson density-density correlation is both of 1 over R cubed. So this is what I mean by algebraic, because it's a density-density correlation is algebraic.
Question. I'm a little confused by the logic. What guarantees that the vertex operator is irrelevant is that the dual theory also has a regularized gauge invariant.
Right.
So what is the logic? Is it the gauge invariance is guaranteeing gaplessness, or what's the logical relationship?
Well, we can say that the logic is the gauge invariance in the dual theory guarantees the gaplessness.
And that's self-duality.
It doesn't really have to be self-duality. I mean, as long as you can prove a gauge theory is dual to another gauge theory, and the dual gauge symmetry is large enough. Large enough means that it's excluded all the relevant terms which is getting there, then that's not good enough. But actually, for all the cases I'm going to discuss, they're all self-dual. So I didn't mention self-dual. But actually, literally, that only has to do to another gating variance system. Another gauge symmetry. Another gauge theory. So that's what it means. And since the vertex operator is always allowed on the lattice, since the fields are always discrete, the vertex operator are always allowed on the lattice. So actually, we always need the gating variance in the dual theory to guarantee that it's irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you want, I can show you some example which the theory is due to a gate theory, but the gate symmetry is not large enough to make sure it's gapless. I also have an example of that, but I don't have time to talk about it in my talk, but I will show you later if you are interested. Okay. And also the algebraic boson liquid phase is also unfine-tuned. It's unfine-tuned in the sense that we can turn on any local small perturbation you want on the original microscopy model. You can have any small perturbation you want on the microscopy model, nothing will change. Okay. And the algebraic boson liquid phase is invulnerable, and the excitations are still gapless. You can turn on any perturbation you want.
How do you see that? So why is it?
You can try to turn on the perturbation and do perturbation theory, and you can see they are not going to lead to any long range correlation. But if you can turn on the perturbation and try to see their try to calculate the effect on the algebraic boson liquid phase perturbatively. And you will see they won't lead to any non-perturbative results. So that you can check directly. And this kind of 3 plus 1 dimensional QED was actually very well understood by Kuryakov like decades ago. And we can just read it from his book.
And it's compact QED?
Compact means that electric field is discrete. the discrete, the electrical can take discrete value, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Why is it called
constant? Because when the electric field is discrete, the vector potential has to be compact by radius 2 pi. It's A, and A plus 2 pi is equivalent.
Okay.
This is what compact means, but, you know, but this way means that the electric field just take discrete value. Okay, so it turns out that there are many, many condensed matter versions of the photon, I mean, of the compact QED. Like there's a 3 plus 1 dimension quantum lattice model proposed by Mossman Sundy and some spin model, parallel lattice, by a Hermele balanced Fisher, and also some string end model by our friend Xiaogang Wen. But basically they're all doing the same physics as the Polyakov's compact QED, just different engineering from the condensed matter system. Okay, so let me briefly summarize what we just did for the photon case. I may have to move faster than I thought. So basically, we started with a model with a U1 global symmetry. Okay, and U1 global symmetry is the only thing I assume in the lattice. And I give her, and I turn some term, so I turn some term very, very large to separate the Hilbert space into a low-end Hilbert space and a high-end Hilbert space. And within the low-end Hilbert space, there's a gating variance, which can be shown by doing perturbation theory of the local hopping on the lattice. Okay. And then we can do the duality and show that because of the self-duality, the vertex operator, which always exists in the dual theory, is actually irrelevant due to the dual gating variance. Okay.
So the point for, so this emergent gate invariance is, this one is local, right? Because
yeah.
Every placket here is,
all right. Yeah.
This gate symmetry. So I kind of understand the positive result. I understand why the gaplessness is guaranteed, because you can't really spontaneously break a local gauge.
Oh yeah, because
so I missed why in 2D you can. I mean, you still have a local gauge imbalance in 2D, right?
Sorry.
So I missed why you can break that one.
Oh, I mean. In two dimensions, the way we gap, so the way we gap out the spectrum is not by breaking the gating variance.
Uh-huh.
It's by proliferating the topological rotation, which is the monopole in the dual theory. Which is the monopole of the gating theory. So we did not break any gating variance.
Oh, you still didn't break.
Yeah, so we didn't break gating variance, but we can still gap out the spectrum by proliferating the topological defect.
Uh-huh.
But in 3+1 dimension, this process is suppressed. Suppressed by the dual gating variance. And this effect can be shown by just calculating,
so
just what I showed, to calculate the correlation between vertex operators.
So, in 3D, the only way to open a gap is to break the local gating variance.
So, you have to condense something in the dual theory to do that. But in two dimensions, we don't. In two dimensions, a tiny bit of vertex operator will already gap out the spectrum.
So I just want to understand how essential is this dimensionality, because I think that in one of the models you cited, the loop model by Wen and Levin,
right.
that also works in 2D, right?
I doubt that. I doubt that. I mean they have many two-dimensional models, but I think most of them are still gap.
There is a gap. It's just
most of them are still gap.
Uh-huh.
They can tune the system to a gapless point, not fine tune. You have you can tune the vertex operator to zero, or you can tune the spectrum to be quadratic, and you can tune something to make sure it's gap, but never fine tune.
Yeah.
But for unfine tuned system, always gap. Okay, so this is the bottom line of the well known example, which means that suppose we want to look for a new algebraic boson liquid phase, we need to look for self-dual gate theory that can emerge through perturbation of local boson hoppings. This is what we need to do when we want to look for a new algebraic boson liquid phase. Okay, here comes a new example of the algebraic boson liquid phase. So I'm going to define bosons on this cubic lattice. Okay? But I'm going to define bosons on both the side and also the placate center. Define boson on both the side and the placate center. And I define 3 component boson on the side and 1 component boson on every placate center. This is what I define. Okay, so now this Hamiltonian, which looks complicated, but I will explain term by term, turns out not so complicated. So this term is again a very simple nearest neighbor hopping, which is a hop boson from the side to the placate center and from the Poincaré center to Poincaré center, which is what this term does. And this term, again, is a local, is an on-site density repulsion term. The repulsion density between this boson and this boson itself, that's a density repulsion term. And this one is a square of the sum of a boson on every site. Okay, just some term like that. And I will tentatively take this term to zero. I will take this term to zero first. And this term is the largest term. It's the most important term, which will impose the gauge, will impose a constraint as the low energy Hilbert space, which I will explain now. Okay, so this term involves boson numbers on six objects, and these are the six objects. It's a square of the sum of boson on these two sides, and also the four plaquettes, Okay. Now I want to make this term very large. So this term will separate the system into a low energy Hilbert space and a high energy Hilbert space. And in the low energy Hilbert space, there's a constraint, which is on every, so the bracket will always vanish. This is the low energy Hilbert space constraint. And now, what is the best way to describe the low energy Hilbert constraint? It is to introduce another electric field, just like what we did before. But now I have to introduce a tensor field. Okay. I define EII, which is a diagonal component of the tensor, equals to NII minus N bar times some sine distribution. And I define EIJ, which is the off-diagonal part of the tensor, equals to NIJ times some sine here. Okay. So now, after I introduce the EII and EIJ, then the constraint imposed by this part of the Hamiltonian will look like this. It's a divergence of the EIJ equals zero. The divergence of EIJ equals zero. This is the constraint imposed by that term. So now if I introduce the tensor potential, So far it has a trace. I will make it trace this later. Yeah. But now it's symmetric. It's symmetric. So it has six components instead of five components. That's six components now. Okay. So now this, now if I introduce the tensor potential A as a sine, some staggered sine times the theta is again the phase angle of the boson creation operator, then we can show that this constraint will generate this kind of a gauge transformation in low energy. And we can see this is a gauge invariance of a linearized gravity, only linearized, not the full diffeomorphism, only linearized gravity. Okay. So now let me show you how this kind of gauge invariance emerge literally by doing perturbation theory, as what I did for the photon case. Okay. Turns out that the perturbation theory, so we have to generate some dynamics which is consistent with the local constraint and also a gauge invariant. And turns out that the lowest order dynamics can only be generated at the eighth order perturbation. It's a very high order perturbation. For instance, we have to hop two particles from this side to these two sides, or the two particles from this side to this side. So this kind of a process will be consistent with low energy constraint. It's a little bit hard to check, but please trust me, it's going to be consistent. Okay. So if I rewrite these terms in terms of the tensor potential I define here, it's going to be like this. Okay. And Rijij and Rijik are the curvature tensor. Because the curvature tensor is going to be gauge invariant. It's gauge invariant under the linearized gauge, gauge transformation. And this is the linearized curvature tensor, which also have six components, which also have six independent components in three-dimensional space. Okay. And both T1 and T2 are eighth-order effect. Okay, we can calculate them. They are both eighth-order effect here. Okay. So now, we can write down our low energy Hilbert. We can write down our low energy Hamiltonian, which is generated by perturbation theory. So now the low energy Hamiltonian is something like E squared plus cosine R and two of the cosine Rs. And we can solve the spectrum. We can solve the dispersion relation by expanding the cosine into R squared. If I expand into R squared and we solve the dispersion relation, it's going to be quadratic. This is because the curvature tensor R involve two spatial derivatives instead of one spatial derivative. So if you solve it now, it's going to be quadratic. Okay. So now we have a quadratic liquid state. Okay. So now we have to do what we did for the photon phase. to guarantee there is a stable gap excitation, to guarantee there is a stable gap excitation, we will have to show that this theory is self-dual. Okay? Somehow we have to show the theory is self-dual. And because self-dual, then the dual theory will have the same gating variance as the gravity gating variance. And then it's going to make sure that the dual vertex operator will be irrelevant. Okay, this is what we have to show.
What excludes the term linear in the trace of R?
Oh, linear trace of R is going to break some inversion symmetry of the lattice.
That's imposed.
But yeah, I mean, that's imposed by lattice model, right? Like we'll have some inversion symmetry. You know, like for that do reflection, A will change sign, since A is a static sign of some theta. If I do inversion, A will change sign, and linear R will also change sign. So that's going to be ruled out by the kind of inversion symmetry.
Okay, but that's the term that in general relativity reduces to Newton's law.
Yeah, I know.
So you excluded it.
Yeah, I excluded it. But I will talk about how we are trying to do that, how we are going to generate it later. Okay. So basically, you have to break up some lattice symmetry in order to do that. Okay, so now let me show you the self-duality. It's actually not easy. I mean, that's pretty easy to show that. So now let me rewrite the computer tensor as this. I introduce another symmetry tensor, which is a Bij, and I introduce a Bii equals to this, and Bij equals to that. And now the most schematic form of the Hamiltonian can be again be written as an E squared plus B squared, the schematic form of the Hamiltonian. And the Bij, if you check very carefully, Bij is simply a double curl of the A. Okay? It's a double curl of the tensor potential. So now we see that both E and B are symmetry and a covariant tensor. Both E and B are symmetry and covariant. Covariant means that I have divergence free. So this structure strongly suggests that the theory is against self-dual, just like the EM field. It's against self-dual.
Sorry, does this B have a geometric interpretation? Or?
No, on the lattice we don't, just some ring change.
But like A was kind of metric.
Yeah.
Right.
A is kind of metric. Well, on the lattice, actually, on the lattice.
But you had this gate symmetry for it, which was the diffeomorphism, basically.
Yes. Well, but that's emergent, though. I'm not sure whether we should call it a metric or not. But a B, if you want to, I mean, okay, so if you want to, so the B is also some tensor field defined on the site. It's a still have a component, you can still call it a tensor, but I'm not sure what kind of geometry term I should give it.
Sorry, just another question. Do you have a sum on the k's or not?
Sorry.
On the definition of the b's, do you have a sum? You have r, I, k, j, k. Is there a sum?
Oh, yeah. So here we sum over j and sum k. Sum over j and sum k. But here we don't sum over I. And here we don't have a sum of k, since there's only one component there. So we don't have a sum.
So this Bij is like the Ricci tensor, right?
Okay, so now now we can write down the equation of motion, the classical equation of motion, for the E field and B field, and we can see that it looks very much like the Maxwell equation. But now we just have to replace a single curl in the Maxwell equation by a double curl. Replace a single curl by a double curl. So this equation is certainly self-dual. We can again switch E field and B field, and this kind of equation will still be invariant. But it's a classical self-dual, right? This kind of equation of motion doesn't give us a classical self-dual. But we can also prove that quantum self-dual and the lattice level self-dual, that's more complicated. So you can read my paper here to show them to check self-duality at the quantum level.
So you've proven it for the specific model that you started with.
Oh, yeah. Actually, not easy to. I mean, it's very straightforward to show that. You know, since that, suppose you want to solve the gate constraint like this, we will have to introduce another dual field H, which is again a tensor field, and I have to introduce Eij equals this kind of double curl structure. Okay, after I do this, the dual Lagrangian will be H dot square minus the curvature tensor of H square minus some vertex operator. And because we have a curvature tensor here, to make sure that this term is irrelevant because it has a dual gating variance. So the theory is actually self-dual in this sense.
You prove that all things are adults.
Yeah.
For your specific model.
Sure, okay. Sure. You can calculate correlation, you can show that it's going to vanish. So this is the algebraic boson liquid phase by the definition I gave. Again, this model is again unfine-tuned. Again, you can modify my original lattice model by any kind of small perturbation. It will not gap our spectrum. You can check that. Okay, so we can calculate density-density correlation, the algebraic power law. And now there's one interesting question asked, whether we can get a linear dispersion or not. Can we modify the model in a certain way and get a linear dispersion? This is a very natural question that everyone must ask. So turns out in this reference, the authors actually turned on a term like this, Aij times the Bij. Their term looks more complicated, but if you write down more carefully, it just looks like this, Aij times the Bij. So because the Bij has two special derivatives, and the E squared basically is A dot squared, and if you solve the spectrum, it's going to give you a linear dispersion. However, this term is not a gating variant, though. If you do the gate transformation, this term will give you a boundary term. It's like a transimus term. So transimus term for the U1 gate field is just A times B. But here is also A times B, so if you do the gate transformation, it's not going to be gating variant. It's going to give you a boundary term. So which means that this term cannot emerge by perturbation theory as what I did. Okay, so far, all the terms I wrote down can be obtained by doing perturbation theory of some lattice model of with only local hopping. But this term can never be obtained that way. Okay, so we can only write it down, but we don't know how to get it from a microscopic model with only near stable hopping. So in this, by the definition of the emergent physics I gave, this term is not an emergent term. Okay. So do we have some other way to do that? Turns out that if we are willing to sacrifice something of the original model, for instance, if we are willing to turn on some long-range interaction, for instance, turn on some Coulomb interaction, like the E squared over Q squared, if we turn on this kind of term, it's going to change the dispersion from quadratic to linear. This is what it's going to do. It's going to change the dispersion from quadratic to linear. And it's actually very easy to understand because we know the Coulomb interaction will gap out the Goldstone mode in the superfluid. Right? Because suppose we have a superfluid and it has the Goldstone mode with a linear dispersion. In there, if we turn on the Coulomb interaction between the boson density, it's going to gap out the superfluid Goldstone mode. So here, if we turn on Coulomb interaction and we solve the spectrum, it's going to change the dispersion from quadratic to linear, which means that the Coulomb interaction will always make the dispersion stiffer, okay, more stiff than before. Okay, so this is one way to get a linear dispersion. Okay. Right. If you want to make sure every term can be generated with local perturbation theory, then we want to avoid terms like this. Right? We want to avoid terms like, well, this term is not gating variant. Then we need to turn on this kind of term to get a linear dispersion. But maybe someone else can think of some smarter way to do that. This is the best way I can find. So. Okay. So. Okay, in the last few minutes, I'm going to modify the model a little bit more and show you something else. So now if we turn on this term, the HV prime term, which I took to zero at the beginning, and if I turn on this term and make this term as large as the HV term, then it's going to generate some new constraint on the lower Hilbert space. For instance, it's going to make this EIJ tensor field traceless. It's going to require that the sum of this guy is zero. So which means that it's not only required divergence-free, it's also required traceless. So if we put these two constraints together, it's going to generate some gate transformation for Aij. So this is the original graviton gating variance, and this is the gating variance which we can add with Aij any trace mode. Okay. So Aij can be added any trace mode, and it's not going to change the spectrum. It's only going to change any physics. Okay. So this is something new introduced by this V prime term. Okay, so now we have to do perturbation theory and generate some dynamics, consistent with the constraint, consistent with the local constraint and also gating variance. And it turns out the lowest order term we get is the 32nd order perturbation theory. That's a very high order perturbation. And it looks like this. It's a E squared plus cosine C, and C is the Cartan tensor. Okay, C is the Cartan tensor. That's the lowest order term you can get. Okay, so now the schematic form of the Hamiltonian will be E squared plus C squared.
How do you go to the 32nd order for the week?
Sorry?
With the hand order.
Just like that's a Hopping diagram I showed you, but now we have to do a more complicated way, so I didn't draw it. It's going to be very messy, so 32nd order. But you can check yourself if you're interested.
Is there some kind of symmetry or some kind of underlying, for example, like a quantum error correcting code, which enables you to just sort of immediately say, oh, look, the first 31 terms have to be zero? And is there some simplification?
Sorry, what has to be zero?
Well, there exist models. I mean, I'm thinking of spin models, but where it's easy to compute what happens in perturbation theory because there's an underlying quantum error correction structure which enables you to just immediately conclude that certain terms in the perturbation expansion are high energy and are eliminated. Is there some structure like that?
I'm not aware of that, but actually the gating theorems will already tell you that. Basically, you have to write down the...
Okay, so there's some underlying structure.
Yeah, some underlying. Okay. I mean, it's very easy to see why a higher order, I mean, why low order terms are not allowed. Because you cannot write down any tensor, which is the gating under the gating. You know, basically, this is a low order term you can imagine. Basically, you just have to count how many order perturbation this term will need. You're going to 32nd order.
So I'm still confused. Aij is not metric?
It is a metric.
It is metric.
Yeah.
So, okay. So,
I mean, well, you can call it a metric, but...
It transforms like a metric, and...
Okay, so the system doesn't really have a continuous value rotation symmetry. It only has a discrete rotation symmetry, because it's on the lattice. Right? You can only do, like, a 90-degree rotation.
But then, let me ask a few more questions, like grad I fj plus grad j fi.
Yeah, I know, but that doesn't mean you can do full rotation.
Sure.
The lattice,
fine.
I mean... So without a full rotation, I'm not sure, I mean, how you should call it metric.
But it has a few morphism invariants.
It's a linearized metric. It's a spin.
Yeah, okay.
You're approaching the conclusion that it's a spin 2 field.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, so with all the gating variables, suddenly this field will only have two polarization. Right? I mean, it has three independent gauge transformations, and you have five component fields. So suddenly you only left with the two component, with the two polarization of the gravity polarization. This is something you can.
And just remind me, the definition of the caret Rij, it's based on Aij, it's the same standard?
Oh yeah, so Rij is something I introduced before, right? So,
yeah.
Oh, Rij is a illusion tensor, it's a...
Is it in terms of Aij, or is it...
Yeah, it is. It's a contraction of the Kovac tensor, it's a Ricci tensor. And this is the Ricci scalar. Okay, so now we can solve the spectrum, and we can see the Z equal 3 dispersion because the C will have three spatial derivatives. And now both E and C are symmetric, covariant, and transitive tensor. This is something we can check very carefully. You can see that the Cartan tensor C is also also symmetric and covariant, also transitive. So this kind of structure strongly suggests the theory is against your view. Turns out it is. We can again prove it on lattice, but again the proof will be nasty, so I'm not going to show you, but you can sort of see it because they have the same problem, right? So symmetry, covariant, and traces. Okay, so we get another algebraic Boson Lipkin phase now. Okay, and turns out the low energy field theory, like this, is identical to the Lipschitz gravity theory of the linearization. But we don't have the ordinary Einstein-Hilbert term. But after suppose we ignore that term, then after linearization, the Lipschitz gravity theory is the same as that. Okay, so recall that to obtain the Z equals 3 phase, we turn on this term. Right? We turn on this term from our Z equals 2 phase. So this means that suppose I reduce the V prime from very large to very small, then there has to be a transition. There has to be a phase transition between our Z equals 3 phase and our Z equals 2 phase. And in the Z equals 3 phase, there's one extra gauge transformation, one extra gauge invariance compared to the Z equals 2 phase, which is this. Right? One extra gauge invariance. So which means that this transition is sort of like a Higgs transition. Okay? But the Higgs transition, we only break part of the gauge symmetry, but not the entire gauge symmetry. Only break part of the gauge symmetry, but not the entire gauge symmetry. And also, we change this version from equals 3 to equals 2, but we don't gap out the spectra. So it's sort of like heat, I mean, sort of like the heat transition. We still make this version more stiff. Still make this version more stiff, but we don't gap out the system. And in our paper, we have a field theory for the transition, but we don't have a very good way to calculate the universality class of transition. So I cannot really tell whether transition in first order, or whether transition or fluctuation in the first order or second order in some universality class. That's something we cannot tell, but I can write down a field theory for it. Okay, it's basically a transition. Okay, so there are some comments on our algebraic boson liquid phase. So the first comment is that it's about non-relativistic dispersion. Why do we have a non-relativistic dispersion in our system? So in condensed matter system, we know that the Lorentz invariant is certainly broken in all the condensed matter system. Okay. And however, the most of the gravitation, most Goldstone modes are still linear, still have linear dispersion. This is because in most systems, the time-reversal symmetry is unbroken. So as long as time-reversal symmetry is unbroken, in the Lagrangian, we always have to write down partial t squared instead of partial t.
So once we have partial t squared and a second term is greater than h squared, then we always have a linear dispersion for most condensed matter systems. So even though we don't have Lorentz invariant, we still have a linear dispersion. So if we tune r to 0, then we get a quadratic dispersion. And this kind of transition is called a Lipschitz transition. It's a transition between a uniform phase and a modulated phase. Because when R is negative, actually, we can see that the system will develop some density wave. There was a density wave with finite momentum Q. Okay, it's called a modulated phase. But in our system, we don't have the linear dispersion because we cannot write down any gauging variant, a locally gauging variant term, which is consistent with the lattice symmetry and also guarantee and also give us a linear dispersion. So the only term we write down can only give us a quadratic dispersion and a cubic dispersion based on this kind of a gauging variant. So the gauge symmetry in our system actually guarantees this nonlinear dispersion. And the second comment is that can we get interacting theory? Can we get an interacting theory instead of a linearized gravity theory? It's going to be very, very difficult because we will have to engineer, we will have to get emergent diffeomorphism invariants instead of the linearized graviton invariance on the lattice. This is something very, very difficult. Okay. And in condensed matter system, we already know how to get non-abelian gauge theory, non-abelian gauge invariance for like SU2 gauge invariance and SU3 gauge invariance, something like that. So that we know how to do. But for the diffeomorphism, we don't know how to engineer so far. But that's something we are trying. We are hoping to do in future. And the third comment is how do we gap out the photon and the graviton? Okay. To gap out the photon and the graviton, we will have to drive a confined-deconfined transition on our lattice, which can be done by condensing some topological defect. For instance, for the compact QED case, to gap out the photon extension, we will have to condense some monopole, which is a topological defect of our system. To condense that, we can spontaneously break the dual gating variance. And once we break the dual gating variance, we actually gap out the system. Okay, so this is a hope. This is a bold hope that we are going to do. Like the Lipschitz gravity theory, the most schematic form of the Lipschitz gravity theory looks like this. It's an A dot square plus the nonlinear of full Cotton tensor square plus Einstein-Hilbert action. And because the Cotton tensor C has much higher derivatives than R, so at the low energy, the theory will flow back to the Einstein-Hilbert action. So this term is more relevant at low energy. But the C square term will be more relevant at high energy. So which means that suppose this picture is right, then suppose we increase the energy scale, we will first see the Einstein gravity, and then at the intermediate energy scale, we will see the Lipschitz gravity, and in the end, we will go back to the lattice model I constructed. Okay. We'll go back to the lattice model with only the U1 global symmetry on the lattice. This is the RG flow diagram we hope to show. Okay, this is a summary. So this has been a very long talk. Thank you for your time. And if you have a question, please ask me.
So two questions. So there's been a lot of discussion in the quantum gravity literature about whether indeed the Hausdorff-Lipschitz theory flows back to the Einstein theory, and the results aren't looking too good. Do you have some wisdom about that? Do you have some new reason we should hope that that works?
No, I don't understand why that way of answering the question.
Okay, let me ask my second question. Is it possible that when Lorentz invariants, if over here we have Lorentz invariants, in your diagram of three things, Einstein, Lipschitz, and the lattice model, here we have Lorentz invariants, here we don't have any Lorentz invariants. Is it possible that in the middle we have a deformed version of Lorentz invariants, that is before the Lorentz invariants breaks, we have a nonlinear realization of Lorentz invariants on the linearized modes?
I haven't thought about that. Sorry, I cannot answer the question. I haven't thought about that. Maybe we can discuss it later. But
okay.
So far, I cannot answer this question. Sorry.
And the 2D example, so I didn't get the part about reproducing the interacting theory. If you do the compact QED, doesn't that, can I consider that as an interacting theory? It's only when you narrowize around the cosine?
Yeah, you can, but I'm talking about the same interaction as the graviton has. So here, if I expand a cosine term, you'll get an interacting term. Those terms are not the same as the interacting with graviton. Depending on graviton, you'll have a different form, because those terms are invariant under the different morphism. But the interaction I will get here is only invariant under the linearized gating errors. So that looks very different.
Yeah, so you could phrase this as saying what you want is to reproduce from a condensed matter, you want to produce a theory which is not compact, but has interaction stuff.
Whether it's compact or not is, okay, let's see. I mean, clearly I want to get a theory which has the same interaction as the graviton, but so far I don't.
Did you have a question?
I didn't know. Okay, so can you go back to just one slide? So this transition from Einstein gravity to Lipschitz gravity and then to the lattice model, shouldn't they basically, what part separates these two transitions?
Oh, they're not transitions, they're crossover.
The crossover,
yeah.
But I mean, isn't it the same energy scale or that characterizes both transitions or both crossovers?
No, since from here to here, I need a very high order perturbation, right? And the perturbation here will lower the energy scale a lot. Remember that, so we have a term to separate the high energy human space and low human space. So you have to go to from low human space to high human space to go to the light model. To see the real bosons.
Yeah.
Right. So from here to here actually there's a very big energy difference.
There's a big energy difference. But what parameter in the original action gives you the energy for that crossover?
The V term.
The V prime.
The V and V prime.
Okay.
Yeah, both of them.
So how about the second transition then from Lipschitz to Einstein?
This one? But depends on the ratio between the coefficient between these two.
Okay. So that all depends on what gives you that Einstein term?
Okay.
Is that right? Is that,
sorry, can you say?
So the Einstein term, I guess you don't really know where to get it. So that in principle, these two crossovers could be arbitrarily.
Oh, yeah, they can be right.
Arbitrarily far away.
But for that, the mechanism to generate R. So far, we have mechanism to generate R.
Yeah, I see.
So,
okay, interesting.
For the case that you have, do you know whether or not the equations of motion are consistent? So, do you know if you take the Poisson bracket of the Hamiltonian constraint of one cell, you don't get zero? Do you know if the theory is consistent? Because, I mean, in normal Lipschitz gravity, it's not clear whether or not the theory is consistent.
Well, I'm sure the equations are consistent. I mean, the linearized, right? It's a linearized equation I can solve with no problem. I can then get all the kind of like EM wave kind of solution, propagating right, and they're not interacting. So, I think the problem, just solving the linearized equation, that's fine. You know, solving the same way as you solve the Maxwell equation.
Do you know anything about the entanglement entropy for the ground states in this model?
Oh, no, I haven't thought about that. anything more specific?
No, I was just wondering if it obeyed some kind of area law or if there was a logarithmic correction.
Oh, I see.
You had the exponential, sorry, the algebraic tails I was expecting.
It's algebraic, it's not that, I mean, it's only, let's see. That's a good question. Maybe in two-dimensional theory, it's going to give us like a LVR law times a log correction.
That's right.
How's possible? Because of the gap is, right? But actually, let me see. But actually, well, I think in ordinary quantum physical point in 2D and 3D, even though it's gap, it's not going to be a log correction. See? In one dimension, you get a log correction. In one dimension, log L times a central chart over 6.
Well, there's no theorem, right?
Let me see. But I think in 2D and 3D, in quantum physical point, my impression, though, it still gives us a area law in modern, still give an area law. Even though the gap is still give an area law. But yeah, but the Fermi system and time entropy will be different. Like the Fermi circuit will give you a lot more excitation, a lot more characterization than a quantum physical point. So here actually something, yeah, so although the gap is extending, will still be localized at the k equals zero, at one single point in the momentum space. So but in the Fermi surface, the gravitation is everywhere on the Fermi surface. So there, actually, gravitation will give you a lot more correction to the entanglement entropy. So there, you'll get an area law times a log correction and some KDF dependent log correction. Here, I'm not sure. But yeah, that's a very good question. Thank you.
Okay, we should finish that. Let's spend the question again.